Hello, Capital Region. This is WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. For the week of Thanksgiving 2020, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is taking time off. Instead of our regular news program, we're playing original pre-recorded content throughout the week. HMM will resume on Monday, November 30th at 6 p.m. On today's program, hear filmmaker Messiah Rhodes in a panel with local anti-incarceration activists as they discuss clemency and the cycle of incarceration that traps so many Black women, with moderator Elizabeth Press. This panel, Against All Odds, was recorded on November 20th.
We are joined today not only by you and your film, but we have this panel of amazing advocates here in New York State who are working on issues that relate to your film. We have Nicole Reed Cook from Freedom Unshackled, Ronnie Minter from Sisters Healing Old Wounds and Freedom Unshackled, and Thomas Kearney from RAP, or Releasing Aging People from Prison. I wonder if this would be a good time to start to bring these folks in and to tell us a little bit about their stories as well. And then we can open up the conversation with the participants here in a broader sort of way. So just to, you know, maybe what I will do is introduce each participant in the briefest of ways, and then each of you can elaborate on what you want to share about your own personal stories and your own advocacy work today in about like 5 minutes apiece. So first, I'm going to toss to Nicole Cook Reed, who served 10 straight years in prison. She is a mom and an advocate working with a group called Freedom Unshackled. Freedom Unshackled is a coalition of different advocates with a goal is to advocate for more uniformed, universal use policies and procedures within the Department of Justice. And I feel like, Nicole, you could probably talk about Freedom Unshackled much better than I can, and also talk about your own personal experience of how you became an advocate with Freedom Unshackled. So I'd like to first welcome Nicole Cook Reed to this conversation and give you some time to tell us your story.
Thank you, EP. Thank you, everybody, for having me. So Freedom Unshackled, as EP spoke about, is a coalition. It's a group of like-minded individuals from a variety of backgrounds. And basically what we do is we come together and we advocate for laws around criminal justice reform. So we're not really trying to change laws and make laws, but we're trying to hold the government and legislative officials accountable for the laws that are already in place. So for example, clemency is one of the big ones that we're working on. And we know that the governor has the right to do clemency anytime he wants. But our current governor Cuomo, who I actually like, has only done a minimal amount of clemency. So we have currently over 1,800 I believe it is 1,800 applications on the governor's desk for clemency. And we need him to do more when it comes to that. He also campaigned around clemency. So again, it's about accountability. That's one example of what our coalition Freedom Unshackled is doing. We're promoting any type of laws that need to be, that are already in place that we're trying to just hold the legislative bodies accountable for doing more of. So for me, obviously EP spoke about me being formerly incarcerated. Messiah and I were talking a little earlier. I was 17, so I was a child and a parent when I was arrested. And I did 10 years in New York State. I did Bedford Hills Correctional Facility between Bedford and Albion Correctional Facility. Those were the two facilities that I did my time in. And so I was my first time ever arrested. Never knew anything about the criminal justice system, but I was taken from my natural element and put into a situation where I kind of had to figure out a new normal. And obviously with the pandemic now, we all know that that's a very scary situation, trying to navigate what is now a new normal. Just trying to be a mother and a daughter incarcerated is something that, you know, you really don't know how to be. I mean, I was lucky enough and blessed enough to have my parents to take care of my daughter. She was 3 when I was incarcerated, and I came home, she was 13. And so, like in Messiah's film, he talked about the struggles that his mother had, because there are really not a lot of resources available for formerly incarcerated people, and especially women. And so I am grateful that I had women before me that had left prison. And when I did finally get released in 2007, they were able to kind of support me into getting on my feet. So mind you, I was 17 when I got arrested, and I was 27 when I came home. So I had no legal history, no job experience, nothing to kind of set me up for success, even though I was told that was what was expected of me. I was on parole. And so that's what the parole officer says. This is what you need to do and figure out how to do it. They don't give you any tools to do it, but this is what the expectation is, or you'll go back to prison. So like I said, luckily for me, I have women who left before me, and they supported me. I was able to hook up with agencies like the Correctional Association of New York. I got a job 4 months after my release, making $15 an hour, which was, you know, a really good thing for me back in 2007. After that, I was able to get my own apartment, worked really hard. I had 5 years on parole, but I successfully completed within 2 years and was cut off parole early. And fast forward to now, I'm a homeowner. I bought my home in Suffolk County. We'll talk about Suffolk County, Long Island. I live on Long Island in Suffolk County and Brentwood area. I'm a supervisor. I'm a business owner. I'm a real estate investor. I'm a registered voter. I'm everything that society says I should not be. And I am just grateful that, you know, I was able to accomplish these things because, it wasn't set up for me to succeed. But it is important. That's why the work that I do, I advocate for, because everybody won't have my opportunity. Everybody won't have my situation. Everybody is not set up for success. Everybody doesn't know how to navigate and get the resources. So it's important that I continue to be that voice for the ones that are behind the wall, that want to get a chance to come home and do right, and continue to do what needs to be done so that we can reform criminal justice.
Nicole, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing. And I hope that after we make our line down through the different panelists, we'll be able to ask you some more questions and you can engage in dialogue with Messiah as well as your co-presenters.
Thank you.
Pass this over to Ronnie Minter. Ronnie is the founder of a couple organizations, include Sisters Healing Old Wounds, and a co-founder of the group we just heard about, Freedom Unshackled. I've had the honor to interview as well on the Hudson Mohawk magazine, and I'll share a link with that about Sisters Healing Old Wounds if people want to listen to that later. But Ronnie, you say your focus has always been on forgotten populations and incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women. You live your life to fight for justice, especially those who were touched by the criminal justice system. Ronnie, I wonder if you could take some time, as Nicole just did, and share some of your story of who you are and how you got to where you are today.
Thank you. First of all, Messiah, your documentary was amazing, and thank you for sharing that, and thank you for allowing me to have the experience of getting to know you and your mom and your sister. So thank you for that. I'm a formerly incarcerated woman, and it was just hard for me to say woman. I don't know why, but I'm formerly incarcerated, and let's just skip to the 2003 incarceration. I started noticing what you call the case at the alcohol and substance abuse counselors that ran programs, facilitated programs within the dorms. It was a living dorm. And I started noticing how when they would open a woman up, let's say they're talking about grief, and a woman is telling her story, she's maybe talking about her mother, her son, her grandmother, somebody. And soon as the 345 movement bell rang, that counselor would grab her pocketbook, her coat, and leave that woman with all this stuff hanging out of her and just go home, right? Then come in the next day and wonder why this woman is now in lock. Well, you left her open, you didn't close her up. You left her to leak all those feelings all over the dorm and she got in trouble overnight, right? So I saw this, and I used to listen to, you know, one of the worst sounds being incarcerated is to be at nighttime when the lights go out and someone in your dorm just found out that a family member has passed away. You will never hear a worse sound while being incarcerated. And so those traumas, those things led me to go to Mr. Siegel, who was our civilian worker at REACH. I was an HIV AIDS peer counselor. And I started talking to him about an idea I had for a group where the woman could come in a safe space outside of the regular program that docs provided and talk for real about childhood traumas. And so he told me to think about it, give him an outline. And so me, Carly, I have to give everybody credit that's due. Carlene Covington and Pauline Toussaint, we would go out to the yard every day. That's where we met because we didn't live in the same unit. And we came up with the name Sisters Healing Old Wounds because we were all sisters regardless of backgrounds, race, whatever. We were sisters and we needed to heal some wounds. And so we went to Mr. Siegel again and we presented it, and the AIDS Institute liked the idea. They liked the concept. So they added that to the cooperative agreement that they had with Rules Opportunity. So we started facilitating the group. The group is actually still going on today, only in Albion Correctional Facility, but it has the longest waiting list of any volunteer program in the Department of Corrections. But in that group, we really tapped on some things. Women were still holding on to child molestations, rapes, being in foster care, being abandoned, being beaten by their spouses or whomever, prostitution. And this was a space where we can really talk about these things. And we knew without a shadow of a doubt what we talked about down there. We wasn't held to all these other rules and regulations that docs had in place, but there was a sense of confidentiality in that space. And so we did that. And we just were unique to have Mr. Siegel, who is just an amazing person, to be our civilian worker. So he allowed us that. Fast forward, when I came home, and I keep thinking about the women, and I kept thinking about how programs like, entities like Oasis and stuff like that, Parole, they tend to be more male focused. Oasis can have a house, and Oasis is the Office of Substance and Abuse. They're the governing body of most licensed programs in the state of New York. And those programs would give maybe 25 beds to a program where 15 beds or 20 beds would be for men and 5 beds would be for women. Parole, we get parole houses where 18 beds would be for men and maybe 4 or 5 beds be for the women. So I kept thinking about this imbalance with women. So I went back to Mr. I called Mr. Siegel, who's my mentor. And I, at the time I was chair of the New York State HIV Prevention Planning Group. So I knew the people of the AIDS Institute. And I asked him if I could have my name back, Sisters Healing Old Wounds. And in 2011, Sisters Healing Old Wounds was born and we became incorporated. And initially the thought was gonna do one-on-one. We were gonna do like direct care. And we started out with a dignity bag initiative because we all know, if you're formerly incarcerated, you know about that $40 of the bus ticket that they give you at the gate. That's not enough. If you're coming all the way from Albion to go all the way to Manhattan, you're not gonna have that $40 by the time you get home. And further, if you have to go out to Long Island, like out by where Nicole lives in Suffolk County, you're not gonna be able to afford to even get home almost if you have to stop and get something to eat. And for women, what if they need personal items? So the AIDS Institute gave us some initiative money. We started a dignity bag initiative, and we got these bags in the hands of most programs that had women coming home from correctional facilities. We have a hotline that's still going on today. We have a hotline for formerly incarcerated women. We do provider trainings where we have conversations with people who work with incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women. And they come and we talk to them about what our needs really are. Because a lot of times when people come home, they don't ask us on these intake paperworks, well, what happened to you while you're incarcerated? They want to know about our mother and father's alcoholism. They want to know what your great grandmother did, but they don't ask you about the time that you just spent, the family that you just left, the years that you just spent. Did you get raped while in there? Did you get beat up while in there? They don't ask you those questions on the intake paperwork. So I saw a gap in services with the women, and we started to try to fill those gaps. So Sisters Healing Old Wounds, along with Freedom Unshackled, tries to address those gaps. And much like Nicole said, we're not trying to change or introduce laws. We're trying to get the laws that are already in place actually adhere to, have them actually do it. So while Sisters Heal Old Wounds is unique to just incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women, Freedom Unshackled is not. We work for and we do everything for incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, and for people who are at risk of being incarcerated. So we're looking at the criminal justice system in a whole. At the same time, being supportive of other organizations throughout New York and the rest of the country, and trying to be a clearinghouse for those organizations and have people get linkage through them, for them through us. That's the long and short of it. I am also a mother, and I left my children at home when I did my incarceration. Much like Nicole, I was lucky to have my mother and father who were able to take care of my son and daughter. However, I am now a grandmother who's raising my granddaughter. I've had her all of her 11 years. I'm hopeful with God's grace and mercy that we could break this cycle here with my granddaughter. So when she has her children, God willing, she's able to raise her children in a healthy way without having to not have them with her. I have cheated myself and my children out of their youth. So I understand that. But at the same token, much like Messiah, my son has absolutely been very happy with all the positive things that I've done in my life since coming home in 2005. And I made a promise that that was not gonna happen again. It was over for me. So thank you.
Ronnie, thank you for sharing this, for sharing your work and your story. as people have questions, feel free to start popping them into the chat. We'll open this up for a discussion in just a bit, but I really feel like your work sort of echoes these services and work that formerly incarcerated folks that Messiah highlighted in his documentary, that they sort of, your life and your work echo those that he highlighted, and you could have almost been another person that he highlighted in his documentary. So thank you for sharing that. Next, we have Thomas Kearney. He is an organizer for the Capital Region with RAP, Release Aging People in Prison. And here in the Capital Region, you've worked on those issues around elder parole, fair and timely parole. And you're out there with Vocal New York. You're out there on local issues. You yourself are also formerly incarcerated and served almost 17 years. And I don't want to tell your story for you. So Thomas, you're an amazing local organizer as well here in the Capital Region. And thank you for joining us today in this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I also want to thank Messiah Rose for putting this together. The documentary was awesome. And I want to take a moment to recognize both Ronnie and Nicole for the amazing work that you're doing there in the Capital Region. I mean, especially the way it's focused on the women, because when we're talking about mass incarceration, a lot of times the women get lost in the conversation. They get drowned out because most of the people who are locked up are men, and the services that you're providing for them are essential and awesome. Like you said, I am a Capital Region organizer for RAP. We organize personally impacted families and those who are formerly incarcerated around two bills, elder parole and fair and timely parole. We get our bills are transformative of the whole parole system. When you say releasing aging people from prison, a lot of people think that that's a population that we're only focused on, but that's the population that our founder was focused on. One of our founders, Mujahid Farid, who today is actually the second anniversary of his passing. Elder parole basically says that anyone who's 55 years and older and has served at least 15 consecutive years in prison has an opportunity to be reviewed by a board. It doesn't mean that you automatically get out. It doesn't mean, it's not a get out of jail free card. It just means that there's an opportunity for your sense of personal transformation to be recognized. Fair and timely parole, which works hand in hand with that, says that when you do go before the board, whoever they is, when your parole time comes up, that the parole board has to evaluate you based on the individual that you are and not the individual that you were when you made the worst decision on the worst day of your life. And that's important. One of the things Fareed has seen in his incarceration, he wound up serving 33 years off a 15 to life sentence, which is ridiculous. The parole board gave him more time than the judge gave him on the front end. And that's what we're realizing. We're realizing that the parole board is basically, as it's set up now, is for vengeance. And it's not really, it's not attempting to help or correct anything that we see in society. With RAP, what we do is we organize personally impacted families. Just speaking like for what's going on now with COVID, we just held a statewide rally outside of a couple prisons as the COVID rates started spiking, as we knew they would in that environment where it's impossible to socially distance. Prison guards decide that they don't want to wear a mask, so they're not going to put one on, and our families and were at risk. So we held rallies outside of Elmira Correctional Facility where almost, I'm sorry, 30% of the population was infected. That's horrible. It's a situation where, I mean, the only people who really care about what's happening there are people who have been there. And as you said, I've been there. And the time that I spent mostly around the elders, the people that we are trying to get out. And those are the most vulnerable right now. We've asked, even before Corona, for, you know, for the governor to grant clemencies, to attempt to release more people, even the most vulnerable. He made like some type of nursing home jail instead up in Adirondack, right there by the Canadian border. And I mean, immediately, COVID infections. These are individuals that could be home. They could be with their families where they're safer. They could be mentors out here in the same way that they were mentors to me when I was in prison. I mean, a lot of this, the violence that we see in the Capital Region, it could be deterred by some of these individuals being home and acting as credible messengers to kids who are going down the same road that they went. Instead, we see the, you know, the legislator and the governor in an election year making very poor decisions, and people are dying because they don't want to look soft on crime. It's a tough situation. But what we, like in New York City on, what is it? Oh, the 23rd, sorry. We're going to be, they're going to be holding a rally outside of the governor's mansion. I'm going to drop the link to that in the chat, as well as a link to our Google form. If anyone here would like to get involved in our work, you could put your information in there, and someone, whatever region that you're in, will hook you up with the organizer in that region. There's if you're on Long Island, if you're in Hudson Valley, we just hired two awesome new organizers that are in the Hudson Valley and on Long Island. So, I mean, moving forward, it's upsetting that the Capitol's closed right now, but it probably would be closed anyway, but we're having a hard time talking to legislators, but we're doing meetings by Zoom. We've already got multiple co-sponsors on both of our bills, and we're hoping that in the next legislative session, we can get some more work done. We can move forward just a little bit more and, you know, get some people home, keep some people safe. Thanks.
Thank you for that, Thomas, and all of you, Ronnie and Nicole and Messiah. I think this is a time now that we can open up again for questions. So if people have questions, please feel free to pop them in the chat. We'd love to talk about them with you. Laura Whitehorn posted the details of the rally that Thomas just referred to. And earlier, much earlier on in the first hour, Luce, who has been so nice and encouraging here to everyone in the chat, had a question about what type of programming is happening now under the backdrop of COVID in prisons. And I don't know if anyone wanted to take that on in answering that for her that we sort of skipped over earlier.
But because every facility is different, it depends on what facility that the individual is in. There are a couple that facilities that are completely locked down now because COVID rates had spiked. I believe Elmira and Auburn are two of them. They're doing some programming. Some schools are still open. Of course, they're still running CoreCraft because, God forbid, Docs gives up some money. But a lot of the stuff that's supposed to be therapeutic and for prisoners is not running at the moment. I mean, I'm really not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing because I'm worried for the people that are in there, especially since they just started mass testing, and I doubt they're going to continuously do it because it costs money. it's hard to tell, but the short answer is depending on the facility. That's how that's you have to check with each facility independently, because DOCS doesn't have a standard for statewide to how to handle the situation.
Thank you, Thomas. Messiah, as you hear like these different panelists start to briefly talk about their stories, I wonder what comes up for you. I know you met a whole host of people across this country as you were making Against All Odds, and many of them didn't actually make it into your final documentary. So I was wondering, if you were to, now engage with these panelists or almost interview them for your project, what would you want to know that hasn't been covered around the work that they're doing here locally?
I mean, I guess New York State is its own, as we learned during the pandemic, even more kind of in an accelerated way, just how almost every state, every county, every region has its own way of governing in some ways. We learned that when it comes to the public health policies that are being passed. So, even if you're looking from outside, don't know about mass incarceration, you probably can assume at this point, I guess the jails might be different. The prisons might be different. The way the law enforcement might be different. When I lived in Virginia and Washington, D.C., it felt like there was it felt like everyone had a law enforcement agency. It felt like the Parks Department had law enforcement, the Mint, the Treasury Department, the state, the street cleaners, everyone had a law enforcement officer, a law enforcement company. So as we deal with mass incarceration in New York State, I just feel like for me, there's always a question this, what reentry services that exist now, when it comes to because I hear stories, either a lawyer might tell someone about a housing situation or, so when it came up, when you first experienced incarceration, how is it finding employment? How is it finding, that first job that made you get income? What was that experience, for everyone, for Ronnie, for Nicole, for Thomas? I feel the fundamental experience of finding that first job. After many interviews, after whether it was a bunch of interviews or just one interview,
Well, for me, Messiah, like I said, I was lucky enough to have formerly incarcerated women that came home before me, that kind of looked back when they came home. And so I was given an opportunity, like I said, with a program called the Correctional Organization of New York, Correctional Association, I'm sorry, of New York. And I did an internship with them at first. And they do a lot of advocacy. They work with individuals that are incarcerated and formerly incarcerated. So I did an internship with them first, and they liked me and my work ethic. We would go to Albany and legislation buildings and stuff like that and advocate for criminal justice reform. And then I got a paid position, like I said, 4 months after my release, my first job ever. And they started me at $15 an hour. And like I said, back in 2007, I don't even know what the minimum wage was, but that was a big deal for me, because I was I got a job, and it's a real job with real money. So like I said, everybody doesn't have those opportunities. If they had, and that's why the advocacy work that we do is so important, because we need more agencies like that give women and men, but mostly women, because like you said, women are kind of the smaller of the population that the services that they have now that they provide. I was really surprised that they didn't have more things for women, because the stipulations on parole are just the same as men. They expect you to get a job. They expect you to do program. I didn't even have a drug history or, incarceration history. And I had to do parole, made me do a drug program, outpatient drug program. So it just, a lot of the things that they ask you to do, they don't set you up for success. So I just feel like the advocacy work that we have to do, it has to really make sure that we continue to be loud voices for the men and women behind the wall, so that we can really set them up for success. As far as I go, I was uniquely lucky because I fit a lot of demographics, right? I'm Black, I'm a lesbian, or transgender. Ask me which day it is, I'll tell you what I am. I'm an ex-addict, ex-con, college-educated, middle-class family. So I came from a lot of things that people could check off on their boxes. So it was easy for me to obtain work because grants kept asking them to hire people with my background, right? And if you really ask a lot of people, because of my lifestyle and my drug abuse, I was high risk for HIV, right? So I was checking off all kind of boxes. And so I don't know if any of you ever heard of Father Peter Young, but my introduction to working in the addictions field and HIV field and really getting my feet wet came through the opportunities afforded to me through Father Peter Young. I will never, ever, ever give more another person besides myself credit for helping me the way Father Peter Young did. And not for nothing, I know a lot of people say, oh, you know, I'm all into, as you can see, Black power and everything. Though that white man opened doors for me, nobody else thought of opening doors for me, and supports me even to this day on his sick bed. And so I can call Father Young right now and say, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? And he will give me his honest opinion, or he'll tell me to go for it. So every step of the way, everything that I've done, when they somehow the New York State, what do you call it? New York State minister, what do you call it? Public health, whoever he was, he appointed me to the New York State HIV Prevention Planner Group. I had no clue what they were. He had just heard about my work. Another door was open because I fit all these demographic check boxes. And as a result of being on a PPG, I then became chair of the New York State HIV Prevention Planner Group. And I was going all over the country presenting workshops and seminars and pushing the idea of reentry and what that looked like for women coming home who are high risk for HIV infection, or at risk, or HIV positive. So I had the opportunity to start pushing their agenda and start pushing my agenda at the same time, going around the country, listening to other people and meeting some amazing advocates in this work. I was able to start making a lot of connections with doors. I mean, literally like Days on Dixon down in Atlanta with the sister house down there. She's an amazing person. The people over at the National Minorities and AIDS Council, like just presenting over and over again at the United States Conference of AIDS. Matter of fact, I pushed so hard for an AIDS agenda that I got started getting offers for these high paying jobs. However, I didn't fit one criteria. I'm impacted, I'm affected by HIV, but I'm not infected with HIV. So I didn't fit that criteria. So some jobs I couldn't take. Right. But I almost fit just about everything else. And that was a passion of mine for a very, very long time, for about 6-7 years. All I did was work on things related to HIV. But then once I branched away from Father Young and started Sisters Heal Old Wounds, I narrowed my focus to just women. And so that became my point of reference. But it was extremely easy for me. It's easy right now. I am asked almost regularly, do I want this position? Do I want that position? Because of my life experiences. And I don't have a problem talking about it, because once I put it out there, what are any of you going to do with it? So I don't mind getting this off my chest. And it's a healing process. And I learned that from the people that helped me along the way.
Oh, sorry about that. I'm just going to add to that and say, I was lucky as well in the fact that I knew people who could probably get me into somewhere. When I first got out, it was harder after the 10, but, it's difficult when you're told to do something and you know that it has to be done. Like the first thing they tell you to do is to get get a job. They want you to get a job. But everyone, they have this like standard parole sheet where everyone's pretty much got the same parole regulations, no matter what you did. I mean, there's something different for other special types of crimes, but basically it's the same thing. I mean, they want you to get a job, but they're not allowed to drive without permission. Why? I have a valid driver's license. It doesn't make any sense. And when it came to employment, I don't think employers know or realize how disheartening it is to get repeated denials. It's hard. It's extremely hard. And for anyone who's just coming out, I mean, it's a really bad situation for anyone to be in, to want to do good. And just because that you have, I mean, you've already done your time, your sense of personal transformation is real and you're ready to get on with your life. But, you know, society isn't still over it yet. They still want to hold you back. That's where, I mean, ban the box, if it ever comes to fruition, it's a good thing. I know there's so many job interviews that I didn't get just because I checked the box. They don't want to hear the explanation. They don't care what happened, how long ago it was. Yes, you were convicted of a felony. No, we don't want you here. It's hard.
So for the next thing I want to like think about for Ronnie, Nicole, and Thomas is about healthcare inside, though. You know, the fact that like you hear stories about doctors can prescribe all kinds of medications and they can prescribe a whole long list of medication. And then when you get out, it's almost like it never happened, you know, because that doctor wasn't even like certified in the first place. You hear stuff like that. You hear like, you know, people don't believe their sick calls, you know, even though it's supposed to be a constitutional right for inmates to have healthcare. But so I want to tie in to like kind of the Zoom questions, like what kind of like registration, what kind of like, you know, things you've been seeing to move forward with healthcare, especially during the pandemic now when it comes to inside.
So there's a lot of layers to that. Depending on what facility you're in, is depending on the healthcare you get, right? I felt while I was in Bedford, I got really poor healthcare, right? But I felt when I moved to Albion that I got really good healthcare, right? I mean, that's the one thing that they did good in Albion Correctional Facility. If I had to give them one thing that they did really well in the Albion Correctional Facility is they made sure there's no reason for anybody to come home without teeth. Well, these are my real teeth, just in case you want to know. But there's no reason for any setup, Nicole, because that's a big thing for me. I get mad when people come home and they don't have teeth, because they will absolutely give you teeth in the Albion Correctional Facility. They want to do that. They want to take those x-rays and do that. They were really big on making sure people were tested. They were really big on making sure, because the truth of the matter is, in 2003, an entire unit almost had syphilis, okay, including the 3-7 officer, right? So, not syphilis, I'm sorry, herpes. So, how does that happen, right? How does that happen? So, they had to up their game on healthcare and education and the messages that we got, right? Now, I am currently having conversations with the sheriff here in Albany about the medical staff at Albany County Correctional Facility, who consistently breaks HIPAA laws, who consistently breaks public health Article 27F, that's the HIV public health laws, who consistently disparage the hell out of women. I personally have, you know, when you're a kid, you have little scars on your arm. Freaking nurse asked me, well, why are you scared of needles since you're such a junkie? Miss, I never shot a drug in my life, but what you don't know is I really know how to write. So I wrote her ass up, and she still has that write up in her jacket. She had to answer that. You understand? I sat there and I wrote notes the entire time I was in Albany County Jail. I took those notes, and when I came home, I sent that those notes to Sheriff Apple, and I said to him, you and me need to sit down because there's too many laws being broken in that jail. And so that's what started the conversation with me and him. But I have a girl right now who is COVID infected in that jail. She's not getting the care she needs at all. She had the COVID. She's having multiple medical issues. She was getting the care she needed in Bedford. She got transferred down here for an appeal. And now she's having all these issues. And Albany County Jail medical staff told her straight up, they are not biting to Bedford to get her medical treatment. Take these Tylenols and go back to yourself. So depending on the facility that you were in, you know, is really according to, you can't put, that's not a blanket thing. That's not blanket. You know, it should be uniformed, but it's not.
So just to really quick, to piggyback off of what Ronnie said, she basically, you know, summed it all up, but like, I was grateful and blessed, I guess, that I didn't have any health issues while I did my 10 years. However, I did have some very near and dear sisters who did, right? And so with that being said, and these are true stories, like I've had women who I did time with would go out for a surgery, right? And come back with a missing body part, like that kind of stuff. Like true story, that's how the medical system is in the Correctional Association. I mean, sorry, the Correctional DOC. So my concern is that if you're not, there's no oversight, there's no medical oversight when it comes to like, you know, NYU Hospital or Stony Brook out here on Long Island, or, you know, even Harlem Hospital or Kings County Hospital, there's no oversight when it comes to these doctors. I don't even know if they're like real MDs or if they're like, you know, training, what do you call it, physicians in training, medical students, I don't know. But there's no, I've seen too many hiccups, and I put those air quotes around hiccups, where people go in for just regular stuff and come back, you know, worse than when they left the unit. So that's just my experience with, and that was also bring people to say like, you know what, I'm fine, I don't want to go, I'm not going to the doctor, I'm good, because it also was a fear factor that I would go for, you know, a cold or something small, and next thing you know, they're telling me I need heart surgery. So that's just my experience.
And just to, you know, like Nicole said, I found that a lot of the medical staff is not DOC, right? It's not part of DOCS, or it's not part of the county jails or the city jails. They're contracted. So Nassau County Jail can have a completely different contract with Suffolk County Jail versus Rikers Island versus Albany or Schenectady. So it's contracted. So when you get into trying to grieve or find out about a medical staff, sometimes that's beyond security. But it helps if you get security to put pressure on them. You know, just like Nicole said, I've seen girls go home and not come back, you know, go to hospitals and not come back. Yeah, I literally watched them let a girl die in her cube that happened in Albion. That, though, wasn't really on the medical staff. That was on security refusing to get her to the medical staff, right? Security refused to get somebody down to the unit or allow us, because we begged them. We begged Michelo, that's his name. We begged him to let us take her to medical. And he was a sergeant, and he would not let us take her. And that girl died right there in that queue.
Briefly, DOCS DOCS as a whole, security staff, medical staff, are unconcerned with prisoner health. I mean, with prisoner health. Their mantra is supposed to be care, custody, and control. They only care about custody and control. They don't care about care. I mean, during the beginning of this whole COVID crisis, I'm sure everyone heard about the shortage of the breathing machines. I can guarantee you that there isn't a single one operating anywhere in docks. Prisoners who are found to be sick from COVID are thrown into solitary confinement. Yes. Solitary confinement with, there is no medical care. Solitary confinement is not conducive to medical care. You got a little window in the back of your cell and a little window in the front of your cell that opens up into a hallway that the CO only opens when he slides your tray through in order to feed you like the animal that they treat us as. It's ridiculous. We have numerous reports of people being denied medical care. Nurses don't even want to walk the rounds if it's locked down because, I mean, they don't want to get sick. It's at this time, it's worse probably than it was before COVID.
I can't even imagine what it's like now and with COVID. I can't even imagine it. You know, the women, someone mentioned Corecraft, the women in Albion Correctional Facility have industry, which they is Corecraft. And Nicole worked in industry and they did painting and welding and, you know, all kinds of stuff at Corecraft. The governor wanted hand sanitizer, right? He took these women who never made hand sanitizer, forced them, instead of working, doing their welding and stuff, all the hand sanitizer that you guys get around here that says, can you see it? New York State hand sanitizer. This is made at, I know it's made at Albion, but I'm not sure what other, I know another male facility makes it too. But literally, Albion Fire Department had to come and actually be in the industry building with them because this is a high concentration of alcohol. And these are women who don't know what they're actually doing, who's getting told, learn as we go. But on the other flip side of that, you can't have this hand sanitizer. So I'm gonna make it, I'm gonna put myself at risk for it. I'm gonna get paid no more than 27 cents an hour for this great risk, but I can't even have this. And these are women who don't know what.
So I wanna move to like, just like the big hashtag of the year, 2020, one of the positive things which become positive. You know it's positive when it causes controversy, which is hashtag defund the police. So like, I feel like a lot of our work, like Ronnie, Nicole and Thomas, you guys have been doing our work even before that kind of phrase even became kind of a thing that people try to bottleneck everything into. But the idea that they allocate these resources from law enforcement, from correctional, from the military, whatever, to go towards reentry services, to go towards supportive services. So like, so can you guys just tell me about the kind of like, what does defund police, when you saw that hashtag is bustling after the George Floyd murder happened, and what did it, how did that affect you when it comes to your work? And how is that motivating you to your work nowadays?
Well, for me, it was just more fuel to my fire. I mean, like we were talking early on before we came on, like, I mean, people get caught up in the verbiage, right? So defund, oh, we need the cops. We're not saying we don't need the cops. That's not what the messages that we're putting out. We need the word defund for me means that we need the police to be, if you're not going to train them properly, obviously, put the money into training people with mental health diagnoses in the community. Because sometimes a person is having symptoms and is acting out as it relates to their mental health diagnosis. Everything is not criminal, right? But if you're law enforcement, you can't really determine, you know, or you're afraid, because that's always the word they use, fear. You're afraid because the person is acting violent or belligerent as it relates to a mental health symptom, right? So put the resources where they belong. If you can't determine a person being violent because of their mental health, or because they're violent because they have a knife or a gun or they're gonna hurt you, then maybe you need to be trained in that or have someone there to assess that, right? So defund the police is not saying we don't need 911. That's ridiculous. What we need is more resources, like you said, Messiah, in the community to help with different issues. Everything should not be a 911 police officer call, right? You know, even like what they said allegedly with George Floyd was fraud money or whatever that initially the phone call was about. That wasn't a 911 call. It really shouldn't have been, right? You know, so we have domestic violence. We have a lot of different things, right? We need to have all of these kind of community resources, you know, instead of having these big tactical teams and armored trucks. Like you see armored trucks in New York and in the United States, it's weird. Like it's not even, you know, it's just weird and it's terrifying. So when people are saying defund the police, ask them what they mean. Like we need those, the money that you're spending on that kind of unnecessariness, where people are getting tear gassed because they're protesting, use that money to kind of put the supports and the resources for formerly incarcerated people that need a stepping stone when they come out, right? Those kind of things in every borough, in every, all throughout. Let's use the money that we're wasting on the police when we see this kind of stuff happening, put it back where it belongs, in our communities, helping the people.
I'm actually not a fan of defund the police. I think words matter, and I think they hurt a lot of Democrats across the country. I think what works in the Bronx might not work upstate New York and Western New York. I'm more for reallocating funds. Same thing, exactly what Nicole just described, is the same exact thing. Move money from this, put it with mental health, put it here, put it there. So, and also I don't believe cops need training. They knew not to hurt the white guy who went in to the AME church and shot up 9 people, right? They didn't need training for that. They knew not to hurt the guy who shot someone at the protest and walked past all kinds of police cars. They don't need training. They know what to do. But again, it's the disregard for Black life, because you have to consider us worthy of life to not want to kill us. So that's a whole nother conversation. Police do not need to be trained. They know exactly what they're doing. It's the culture of corrections. It's the culture of the Department of Justice. It's a culture that dates back, way back to the ownership of slavery when you had slave catchers. So that's the birth of the police department. So this is a conversation that's bigger than just this right here, right? But again, I think the words defund the police automatically put a shield up, and some people can't even hear you. They're not even engaged in the conversation, and you can't get past that word. And I wholeheartedly believe that this is what is going to cost us greatly. And unless we start really, if we really want to have a conversation about what needs to happen. And I understand some people are radical and they say, man, F the police, and we need to do it like this, we need to do it like, I get that. But I'm a realist. And so having a conversation, I want to have a conversation, I can get the same result with the word reallocation versus defund.
You just heard Messiah Rhodes in a panel called Against All Odds with local anti-incarceration activists as they discuss clemency and the cycle of incarceration that traps so many Black women. Remember, while we stay home to protect our loved ones, many families are not able to be together because their loved one is incarcerated, and those in the prison system are twice as likely to die of coronavirus. You can see Messiah's film, Against All Odds, and the full panel discussion on our YouTube page at youtube.com/mediasanctuary. HMM will resume on Monday, November 30th at 6 p.m. Until next time, folks, stay safe.